Welcome to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. This week with me, Annabel Quince. And today, the story behind emissions trading schemes.
Concern over the government's emissions trading scheme has brought a group of economists together. 10 economists from across Australia have called for the trading scheme to undergo significant change or be scrapped in favour of a carbon tax.
The coalition is trying to embarrass the federal government over its decision to scrap an inquiry into its emissions trading scheme.
Penny Wong was up early yesterday morning on radio defending the emissions trading scheme against another assault by the coalition. At the end of the day, now in a Senate committee, she was still at her task.
You're now a part of a party that's seeking to run an allegedly greener policy.
Oh, Senator, please.
I just wonder if you support it, Senator.
Australian federal politics at the moment is dominated by debate over the Rudd government's carbon pollution reduction scheme. The scheme, a cap-and-trade scheme for carbon dioxide, was announced last year and immediately came under fire from environmentalists, who claimed that its targets were too low and the compensation given to major polluters too high. Last week, a group of 10 economists from across Australia called on the government to scrap the scheme in favour of a carbon tax. And this week, the opposition leader Malcolm Turnbull has entered the fray by pledging to set higher carbon reduction targets and establishing a Senate inquiry into the scheme. So with emissions trading firmly back on the political agenda, we thought it was a good time to revisit a Rear Vision from last year that looked at the history of carbon trading schemes and at just how effective they really are at reducing greenhouse gases. The idea for emissions trading first emerged in the 1960s in the United States. Donald McKenzie is Professor of Sociology at the University of Edinburgh and specialises in the sociology of financial markets.
Cap and trade is essentially an invention by economists, particularly a Canadian economist called J.H. Dales, writing in 1968. He was the first person who put forward the idea of an emissions market in something like a fully fledged form. During the 1970s and the 1980s, people, primarily in the United States, did try to set up these markets, but they did it in a kind of ham-fisted sort of a way, and the markets really, on the whole, weren't very successful. What essentially got the idea going and made it influential was when, in the United States, the market in sulfur dioxide was introduced. Now, sulfur dioxide is produced by electric power stations, particularly those electric power stations that burn coal. So people set up a cap and trade market in sulfur dioxide in the United States. They passed the legislation in 1990 and trading began in 1995. And that was really a pretty successful market. If you tried to reduce sulfur dioxide by traditional means, you'd have done something like have a piece of legislation that says that no power station is allowed to emit more than a certain proportion of sulfur dioxide in its emissions. The idea of cap and trade is that the flexibility that the trading gives you enables you to make the reductions a bit more cheaply. And by and large, the economists who analysed the American sulfur dioxide market did indeed find that that was the case. So the cap was met, but the costs of doing it via trading in these economists' analyses were something like half of what they would have been if traditional means had been used.
I think there's several points to be made about this comparison. First, yes, it's true the sulfur dioxide scheme, relatively speaking, was more successful than the other pollution trading schemes which were tried out in the U.S., most of which were dismal failures, whereas the sulfur dioxide scheme at least had some success in reducing costs, apparently, although that's still controversial.
Larry Lohman works with an environmental and social justice research NGO in the U.K. called the Corner House.
However, there's a lot of differences between the sulfur dioxide scheme and any scheme which would use cap and trade to reduce global warming gases. One of the first differences is that the sulfur dioxide scheme was very carefully designed so that it did not include what are called offsets, that is, special pollution-saving projects which allow polluters to continue polluting as long as they invest in some special project elsewhere which is supposed to save pollution. And the fact that there weren't these offsets, which are very, very complicated, very, very difficult to measure, and very, very controversial, helped the sulfur dioxide scheme in the U.S. achieve some coherence. However, every single greenhouse gas trading scheme which has been proposed, including the Kyoto Protocol, including the European cap and trade system, also include these very complicated offsets. Another big difference between the sulfur dioxide trading system in the U.S. and any global scheme to use cap and trade to control climate change is the whole problem of measuring emissions. The sulfur dioxide scheme in the U.S. became possible only because there were relatively few sources of sulfur dioxide to worry about, and the emissions from those sources could be measured by the mid-1990s. So you had quite a good monitoring and measuring system possible. However, when we turn to the issue of global warming and greenhouse gases, it's a quite different matter. I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of sources of carbon dioxide. We're talking about a whole range of greenhouse gases, not only industry, we're talking about transport, we're talking about land use, emissions from cattle and so forth. I mean, it becomes very complicated. And of course, that measurement problem is compounded further by the fact that if you've got some kind of emissions trading or cap and trade system that's global in nature, then you're talking about different jurisdictions, different national authorities. So there's a lot of dissimilarities between the sulfur dioxide situation and the carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas situation.
How did emissions trading become part of the Kyoto Protocol?
Well, here basically we got to look at the influence of the United States on the negotiations that led to Kyoto. And of course, it was the Clinton administration at the time. They were very taken by the success of the US sulfur dioxide market, particularly by the fact that the costs of making the necessary reductions seemed to have been pretty low, certainly a lot lower than people had feared. So essentially the Clinton administration thought, we found an effective tool domestically for controlling emissions, and let's try it internationally. A lot of the rest of the world wasn't at all keen on that. They feared, for example, that what trading would do would be allow people to, as it were, buy their way out of making the emission cuts that were necessary. But the US was very influential. Its Kyoto delegation was very energetic, very professional, and by and large, they managed to pull the rest of the world along with them.
I think there are three things. That at the time the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated, green parties were a part of the government in both Germany and in France, and were basically hostile to the concept.
Denny Ellerman is a senior lecturer at the Sloan School of Management, MIT, and specializes in emissions trading and energy economics.
Now, the politics changed within Europe. There were several things that happened. On the one hand, the Europeans recognized that they were in danger of not meeting their targets. As they went into the turn of the century, around the year 2000, there was a growing awareness that Europe was not going to meet its targets, which they thought they were going to do before. And they needed something else. And this became the only means that seemed feasible, because they had proposed a unified carbon tax in the 1990s, and that had failed. So there was nothing else left. Then you had, about the same time, when President Bush, the second President Bush, rejected the Kyoto Protocol. That led to a diplomatic effort by the Europeans to salvage the Kyoto Protocol. And that meant going back to the parties such as Canada, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and compromising and embracing emissions trading in order to salvage the Kyoto Protocol, to which they place a lot of value. And once it became evident that that was the only way to get what were called the umbrella group countries, that is the United States, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Russia, to agree was going to have to embrace emissions trading. So it became much more a part of the protocol than it had been before. It was a part of the protocol in 1997, but let's say the European position evolved where they then created their own trading system.
The European Union scheme, which includes about half of all Europe's carbon pollution, began in 2005.
The European Union scheme in its first phase, which ran from January 2005 to December 2007, was overallocated. Too many permits were handed out. The consequence was that by the end of 2007, you could buy the right in Europe to emit a ton of carbon dioxide for 4 euro cents, you know, for like trivial amounts of money. And it's not only the European Union scheme that's been afflicted by this tendency to overallocation, because it's essentially a political process. It's a difficult thing to set up a carbon market, and it can easily be blocked by lobbying against it from industries who think they're going to suffer and so on. So the easiest thing to do in terms of setting the thing up politically is to buy off potential industry opposition by being generous in your allocation of allowances. Now, I'm not saying that in Europe that was consciously done, but the people who were setting up the scheme knew that it was always politically a bit precarious. You know, if they had been too tough, for example, with the member states and their national allocation plans, then you could imagine a European summit being called and the countries of Europe saying, yeah, let's just postpone it for a few years, you know, and that would have kicked it into the long grass and nothing would ever have happened. So the people who were getting the scheme going knew that there were political risks in being too stringent. And their hands were also a little bit tied by the problem of data, you know, because we might think that in advanced countries we kind of know how much carbon dioxide we're emitting pretty accurately, but the reality is that we don't know that with any great precision, because the figures at national level are a bit blurry, and when you get down to the level of particular installations, well, you know, who in the past has ever tracked the emissions of carbon dioxide from those installations? So the data on which the caps were set were just a little bit flaky, and that also contributed to the problem of allocating more allowances than actually were needed.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web with me, Annabelle Quince. Today, we're taking a look at the history of carbon trading. One of the key aspects of any carbon trading scheme is how the permits to pollute are allocated.
At the beginning, the designers of the system, the economists, said, well, what you do in a cap and trade system in order to impose a cap is the government hands out a limited amount of rights to pollute to industry. And most economists would agree that, you know, the best way of doing that is to sell those pollution rights to industry, to have an auction. And different industries bid on them, and the revenue goes into the government kitty, and the government can then use that for, you know, beneficial purposes, preferably to do with dealing with the global warming problem. But what's happened in Europe is that this was not even on the table at the beginning, because it was felt to be, you know, oh, this is too much politics. What we'll have to do is to give the pollution rights away for free to industry. Otherwise, industry will kick up a fuss and they'll complain that it's too expensive. How do we allocate them? Well, I guess we'll have to allocate the biggest number of pollution rights to the biggest polluters, because otherwise they will squawk. So what happens is that you, in the end, you have a system which is a polluter gains or a polluter wins system rather than a polluter pays system.
In effect, what auctioning does is to transfer money from industries to governments. And of course, industries don't like that. They'll lobby fiercely against it. Auctioning, for example, now is on the political agenda in Europe, but there's a great deal of industry lobbying against it. So again, essentially, it was a politically necessary feature of setting up a big novel scheme in a situation of a lot of political controversy potentially. It was politically simpler to allocate allowances for free than to try to auction them.
But did that have the ramifications that some producers of carbon actually ended up almost making a windfall from them?
It absolutely did. And this, I must admit, because I'm not an economist, this took me a little while to get my head around, because, of course, you know, one immediately thinks, supposing you're an electricity producer and, hey, the government's just given you this big bundle of free allowances, well, you would think that that wouldn't affect the price of electricity because you get the allowances for free. But an economist will quickly tell you that that's not so. An electricity generator, after all, it's a profit-making company. And once you've got allowances, even if they're free allowances, they can, of course, earn money by selling off those free allowances. So what happened was that the market value of those free allowances got built into the price of electricity. In other words, the price of electricity was higher than it would otherwise have been. So electricity prices rose even though the companies were getting not all the allowances for free, but a good proportion of the allowances for free. And of course, that boosted the profits of the European electricity generators. They made windfall profits out of the scheme. They're still making windfall profits, even though we're now in the second phase of the scheme. The UK regulator reckons that during the second phase, the current phase of the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme, which runs from January 2008 through to December 2012, the regulator reckons that the UK electricity companies are going to make a profit of £9 billion.
So the electricity companies have made a bigger profit and consumers have paid more for their electricity.
Exactly, exactly.
Another feature of emissions trading schemes are the carbon offsets. That's where a company in Europe, America or Australia buys carbon credits from a company in the developing world, which has supposedly reduced its own carbon emissions.
There's one issue that often is not talked about enough, and that's the issue of the side effects that some of these offset projects are having on ordinary people's lives. When you look at how this offset system works, whereby the special projects are set up in countries like India or Brazil in order to save carbon, often you find that the beneficiaries, the people who are actually selling the carbon credits from those projects, are often the worst corporate citizens in their locality. The people who are making the most money out of selling carbon credits to Europe, to Australia, to Japan, and so forth, are actually some of the worst corporate polluters, some of the worst corporate offenders in countries like South Africa, India, and Brazil. I'm thinking, for example, of sponge iron manufacturers in India who have taken over farmland, they've depleted water, they've polluted the air, they've caused all sorts of health problems. And for these industries, the carbon offset market is a bonanza. They can make a lot of money simply by saying they are making minor improvements that they would not have made otherwise in their industrial operations. Whereas from the point of the view of the local people, those industries themselves are the problem. And this is not a sort of exception in the carbon offset market. It is the rule.
So has Europe's ETS led to a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions there?
We would argue the figure we use is that we estimate that emissions were reduced anywhere between 2 to 5%. It's definitely had an effect. And I think what everyone has to understand is that, at least during the trial period, that's the period up through 2007, the ambition of the European program is very modest. It was not requiring big reductions, and it did not get big reductions, but it did. That price of carbon did have an effect. I mean, I think that's irrefutable.
So basically, you think the emissions decrease was somewhere between about 2 and 5% over the three-year period?
Yes. 2 to 5, probably. I'd be surprised any more than 5%. I think at least 2%, somewhere in there. But it had an effect. The carbon price did.
I mean, I guess a lot of people would say, actually, that's a pretty small amount. And if that's really all carbon trading can do, is it the best method to actually use?
Well, it is a small amount, but I'll go back to the point I made. The ambition is very modest in the European system. And I would observe that everywhere we observe any sort of real carbon constraint, the ambition is modest. Now, the ambitions are very great for 2050, but that's 40 years from now. And the task currently, is, and the view would be in Europe, is simply to have a mechanism in place that puts a price on carbon, that starts changing investment decisions, changing operational decisions, encourages innovation, and will lead to a transformation over a much longer period of time. It's not going to transform it immediately. Europe looks very much today just as it did 3 years, 4 years ago before they had a carbon price. It's had effects, but you wouldn't see it if you traveled to Europe and went around. It wouldn't look any different than it did in 2004.
One thing that just about everybody agrees on now is that in order to deal with global warming, we're going to have to tackle the major polluters. I'm talking about sectors like the electricity generating sector, chemicals industry, cement, transport, aviation, and so forth. However, cap and trade is actually designed to do just the wrong thing. It's designed to give the major polluters an incentive to delay. How does that work? Well, if you're a major polluter and you're locked into fossil fuels, you have your whole capital plant committed to fossil fuel dependence, obviously it's going to be a very major task for you to think about switching over to some other kind of business or switching over to some other kind of generation than fossil fuel dependent generation. And obviously you don't want to do that right away. And cap and trade actually gives you a means for not doing that right away, for delaying. How does it do that? Instead of starting to invest in a different path, a different development path, a different kind of generation, you can simply buy cheap carbon permits or pollution rights from people who have them to sell. So it actually gives the big polluters, the ones who are most strongly committed to fossil fuels and who have most at stake, another incentive simply to delay, to put off action. And is this what we really need with the global warming problem? Yes, of course, cap and trade in the short term would save those big polluters money. But are we really dealing with the root of the problem in fossil fuels if we're allowing the people who are most dependent on fossil fuels simply to delay that crucial first steps in reinvesting in a different way of doing things? And this actually also addresses directly the question of cost savings. I mean, the big calling card of cap and trade systems is that they save money, especially save money for industry. But the question is, save money over what time span? And the answer is cap and trade saves money for the big polluters in the short term. But everything that history teaches us about industrial transformation tells us that actually what matters in a problem like global warming is the costs over the long term. And it could well be that by giving the big polluters today a breathing space, allowing them to delay, we're actually building up costs for the long term.
Momentum is building for the federal government to rethink its emissions trading scheme. The Greens leader, Senator Bob Brown, says the present plan is flawed, arguing it rewards big polluters. A group of Australian economists agree, but they want the government to consider scrapping the scheme altogether. They say a carbon tax would be a better way of lowering emissions. The opposition isn't ruling out the idea. Its emissions trading spokesman, Andrew Robb, says a carbon tax would be simpler.
If one had a free political choice, then I think there are good arguments that emissions trading isn't the way to go, because a carbon tax in many ways is actually a simpler kind of instrument, and indeed in some economic analysis it's seen as having preferable properties to emissions trading. So a combination of a carbon tax, direct government support for research and development, maybe sort of, you know, public investment in the big stuff that needs to happen, like refashioning electricity grids so that you can make the best use of renewables, in a package like that would be very attractive. But of course, you know, we do live in the real political world, and one of the great advantages of emissions trading schemes is that they're often politically feasible in contexts where simply a carbon tax isn't actually politically feasible, because what an emissions trading scheme can do is to create a kind of alliance between environmentalists who are on the left, by and large, and free marketeers on the right, who like the trading aspect of it. And that kind of alliance can actually be quite important politically. But what I would say is this, that if you're going down the route of carbon trading, you've got to make sure that your carbon trading market is effectively designed. And above all, you've got to make sure that you're not actually handing out more permits than are really needed, because if you do that, then the whole thing becomes kind of pointless. What's happened in Europe, and I think this is an important thing to say, that despite all those problems in the first phase of the scheme that ended in December 2007, the very existence of the scheme has changed the political landscape in Europe. When the scheme was first started, you could easily imagine it being blocked. Now it's there, very hard for people who are unhappy with it to stop it existing. So what's happening in Europe is that the scheme wasn't very effective when it first started, but it's getting more effective, and I could imagine it becoming more effective still in the next phase of the scheme that begins in 2013, because then we might start getting significant auctioning, for example, rather than free allocation. It's taken time, but I think the European Union scheme shows that with good planning, a dedicated, skilled team of people at the centre, and I'm very impressed by the European Commission people who set the scheme up, and at least reasonable levels of political support, then you can get a carbon market to work.
Even if we could get a cap and trade working as the economists would like it to work, is it going to be enough to actually reduce greenhouse gases enough to stop the environmental damage that lots of people fear is on the way?
It's a good question. I think the answer is no, partly for a reason we haven't yet talked about, and that is that this whole cap and trade system actually diverts our attention away from the real problem we should be addressing, which is our overdependence on fossil fuels and what sort of measures as a society we need to take in order to overcome that dependence. Instead, a cap and trade focuses on, okay, well, what targets do we want? Do we want 5% by 2012, 5% reduction in fossil fuel emissions by 2012? Do we want 40% by 2030? Do we want 80% by 2050? And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with concentrating on these aspirational targets. But the problem is that a cap and trade system tends to assume that there's no problem with how you do that. All you have to do is set a target and then make the pollution rights scarce so that people pay a high price for them, and then automatically society will move on to a more sustainable path. I don't think that's true. The real question is how we actually going to get away from fossil fuels, which are at the root of the global warming problem. Cap and trade puts way too much emphasis on prices as a way of achieving that kind of structural change. And everything we know from history tells us that prices actually do not achieve the kind of structural change that we're thinking about, that we're contemplating in terms of global warming. It's the wrong instrument. And if we rely too much on price to change everything, even if we can get those prices, which so far has turned out to be politically not feasible, even if we could get those prices, as in the ideal world of the economists, a price in itself is not the way you achieve that kind of structural change. Structural change is achieved through a lot of other things. It's achieved by making a social choice, by people getting together and deciding, okay, we want to redirect public investment. We want to redirect subsidies. We want to have a different kind of transport system. We want to have a different kind of energy system. And those things can't be achieved simply by price.
Larry Lohman, ending today's program. Our other guests were Donald McKenzie and Denny Ellerman. The sound engineer was Jenny Parsonage, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince. Thanks for your company.